Today, let's talk about avoiding the things we often bring about trying to avoid them.
Welcome to Coffee with Creamer, where you get to sit down with our host, Dr. Barry Creamer, for a conversation about faith, life, and culture. We'll look at old ideas through a new lens, turn those culture wars on their head, and paint a picture of the way things could be. If you like your thinking deep and your coffee hot, pull up a chair. You're in the right place.
Now, I know it sounds odd, but it is the truth that we manage to produce very often the very things that we're trying to avoid. It's part of what's built into the way we live with other people because of the way we think that we're controlling the world around us and that we live entirely within the means and controls that are ours alone, but in reality live as part of a system with other people. And while we think we want the system to change, it is what it is because it's the way we're used to it and the way we actually feel most comfortable. And so even the things we think we're doing to bring about change actually fit right into what we're already doing. This is a theme I've brought up several times in several of the podcasts, in several of the episodes, that is, that are available at barrycreamer.com, obviously, if you want to go look them up. And it's a way of thinking about human relationships and also ends and means that grew in me or developed in me while I was taking a counseling class here at Criswell College. And I'm recording here, the studio's here at Criswell College, where I serve as the president now. But when I was a student in my Master of Divinity program, way back in the 90s, I took a course under Dr. McGuire, who covered systems theory. And it just changed my whole understanding of how people function. And this is largely informed by that, although I'm not going to go into systems theory today. That's not what it's about, and I'm not an expert on that. I have strong views about it. It heavily shapes the things that I do, but it's not my discipline, not my area. But my practical experience tells me how often we end up bringing about the thing we're trying to avoid. And, you know, I want to start not with, you know, not with really the points that I want to get to today, and this goes in a bunch of different directions, but with something less painful, something less consequential, some innocuous examples, so to speak. So suppose you are getting ready for a big, special, important meeting on a given day. And I've seen this happen over and over again. You're getting ready for a special meeting, and so you're going to, you know, make sure that you get up on time, maybe get up early. And this is so important. I can't rely on this way that I normally have of getting up in the morning because I might oversleep. So I'm going to go buy a new alarm, and I'm going to set it up, or I'm going to set up my alarm in a special way. I'm going to put it in a special place or whatever. And by doing that, we're introducing all kinds of variables that could fail. Everything that we change is something we're trying out for the first time. Everything we change puts us in a position where we are more likely to make a mistake in how we set things up and whether we're actually going to get up for that meeting or not. And when we make that mistake and it doesn't work, then the very thing we were trying to avoid, which is any possibility at all of missing this meeting, is actually more likely than it was before. The same thing happens with so many, like, you know, you're going somewhere special, you have a passenger you're going to take. Oh, I have to pick up the president. I'm really going to need to be careful this time. So I'm going to take a special route. I'm going to drive super cautiously. But in all of those things, a special route or driving more cautiously, you're doing things you're not familiar with. You're going to be prone to make mistakes because you're doing things differently. It's just part of our nature that there's a way that we do things. And those are the things we're most familiar with, and those are the things we're most likely to succeed at. And yet, when change comes, we want to introduce more change so that we can be sure we don't, and you see the direction that can go. If I were to put it in terms of Scripture, there's a proverb, and actually this is introduced in the first chapter of the book of Proverbs, but it comes back in a singular proverb in Proverbs 26:27, when it says, "Whoever digs a pit will fall into it, and a stone will come back on him who starts it rolling." So here you are trying to bring about this judgment of someone else, and you end up bringing about judgment on yourself, bringing about the very opposite of the thing that you wanted to do. It's part of our nature. I've always used the Chernobyl nuclear disaster, you know, the atomic accident that happened, as an example of this. In 1986, when Chernobyl exploded, you know, and radioactive debris was thrown into the atmosphere, and Belarus and other nations throughout Europe actually were affected by the radioactive fallout from that horrible accident that took place. The reason the accident took place, and here I'll quote it from this source that has to do the nuclear something, atomic energy, something or another, provided this information. This is a quote from their own description of what happened, this nuclear regulatory agency. They were the workers at the Chernobyl plant in 1986 were conducting a test, and they were preparing to conduct a test to determine how long turbines would spin and supply power to the main circulating pumps following a loss of main electrical power supply. Well, why do you do a test like that? Because you want to make sure that you're not going to get into a situation where you wouldn't have enough power to keep the rods cool and to keep the reactor under control so that it wouldn't go into a meltdown and explode. And by doing the test to avoid a nuclear explosion, they brought about a nuclear explosion. We are all the time, and this is not just a quirk. Just think about it. This is what happens when we're trying to avoid things. We introduce new things into a system which can bring about the very thing that we're trying to avoid. Saul does it. One more innocuous example, but from Scripture again. Saul does it in 1 Samuel 13. This is right after he becomes king. I mean, he's only been king for a chapter or so, only had one really good thing happen. And immediately he's facing the Philistines. He's ready to lead Israel into battle against them. But he's facing a more significant Philistine force than Canaanite force, than the people that he has with him. And so he fears that the people are going to leave him. And earlier, Samuel had told him, hey, look, gather the people, meet over here, wait there for a week. After 7 days, I'll meet with you. I'll offer sacrifices. We'll ask the Lord's blessing. You know, I'll lead you. But you have to wait for me. But Saul, in his fear, thinks that Israel, who've gathered together with him, and now they're just sitting on their hands and not doing anything, that they're going to be scattered. And he knows he's facing Philistines, and he's afraid he's going to face them without Yahweh's favor. And so he offers the sacrifice out of turn. He's supposed to wait in Gilgal for 7 days, but Samuel hasn't turned up on the seventh day, and he's like, I need to offer the sacrifice. But, as soon as Saul offers the sacrifice out of turn, Samuel shows up, of course. Because he wasn't going to leave him hanging, but Saul is so afraid that God is going to turn away from him and not bless him that he offers the sacrifice immediately anyway. And Samuel's statement to Saul is this: you have done foolishly. You have not kept the command of the Lord your God with which he commanded you. For then, if you had kept it, the Lord would have established your kingdom over Israel forever, but now your kingdom shall not continue. The very thing you are trying to avoid, losing the kingdom, is what's coming your way because of what you did in order to try to avoid it. We do this all the time, where we manage to produce what we're trying to avoid. We do it relationally. These a couple of other examples just along the way, so you can see how ubiquitous this problem is. Parents, you know, who have kids who are about to become adults, right? We get into a situation. My kids are long, they've long been adults. I learned this lesson a long time ago. Parents of children who are becoming adults notice this happening. So their kids start wandering. They start staying out late. They start doing things on their own. They start testing the boundaries of, guess what? Adulthood, because they're going to be adults before long. And so they're trying to figure out how to interact with somebody less as a parent, less as a child on their part, and more as an adult dealing with another adult. So obviously they're going to start sort of testing their boundaries. What do parents do? Oh, they start worrying. Oh, he's staying out late. He's making bad decisions. I'm not sure he's going to be respectful of his parental authority and so on. And so what do? They start setting harsher rules, acting as if adulthood is not an option. And by fencing them in more tightly, by reining them in, by treating them more like the children they're trying not to be anymore, we result in, you know, a few things can result from it. One, stunted development, you know, the failure to launch kind of idea. Okay, you want to suffocate my adulthood? Fine, I'll be a child. You figure out all of my decisions. You decide everything for me. You provide everything for me, and so on. Or we motivate a premature or immature launch where they're fleeing or fighting against the restrictions that you're putting on them. Oh, yeah, you're going to tell me what to do? Well, I'm 18 years old. I'm going to run away. Or 17 years old or 14 years old or however old they are when they start thinking along these lines. And if you think about it from, and by the way, both of those are examples of producing what you're trying to avoid, which is having your child act immature when they become an adult and having your child run away when they're not mature enough to be an adult. You don't want either of those to happen, but we bring it about by the way we respond, inappropriately, of course, as our children are trying to become adults. And if you look at it, by the way, if you look at it from the other perspective, I'm not just trying to be critical of parenting. Parenting's always a challenge. I'm saying also from the kid's perspective, if I were talking to a teenager, I would be saying the same thing. Don't bring about the thing you're trying to avoid. And so from the offspring perspective, they're trying to push toward their freedoms, but they are causing the restrictions that are being brought down on them by the way they're pushing toward their freedoms. And so I'd be saying to a teenager, look, you're bringing this about because you're not approaching this like an adult should approach it. Sit down with your parents, have a conversation. Don't just run off and rebel against these things and so on like that. And by the way, when I say that to teenagers, very often I have to say to them, you know, what I need you to realize is that in this situation, you can't control your parents. I can't control your parents. They're not asking me for help. But I can encourage you to act like the adult in this situation. And they will, I'm not the adult. I'm the kid. I'm saying, but you want to be the adult. And this is your opportunity to be that. So you become, and I'll explain some more about that in just a moment. So, you know, or think about a relationship you want to strengthen. You got a relationship with somebody, a friend or whatever it is, and you end up suffocating the relationship because you don't want to give up any ground, you know, no alone time for the other person. You're constantly checking in. Hey, are you still my friend? Are we still? And you end up suffocating the person that you're trying to keep close to you so that they're desperate to get away from you. We bring about the thing that we're trying to avoid. Anytime, by the way, in your experience that you have the same argument every day with someone, whether it's a boss or a teenager or a parent or somebody else or a teacher or whatever it is, anytime you have the same argument with somebody every day, like when your kids are going to bed, you know, time to go to bed. Oh, no, we're having this argument again. Why do we have this argument every day? Or get up or get your homework done or whatever it is. It's because the argument has become part of the routine for the other person. By participating in that argument, you have produced an environment that's going to generate that argument every day. It's the opposite of why we were willing to argue with, you know, to begin with, which was to avoid this behavior. And yet we're producing the behavior by being willing to participate in the argument. I always say to people, by the way, who get into this situation, and this happens all the time, I always say to them, be the half of the relationship you wish existed as a whole. The half you can control, your half. Like you want a relationship where you're speaking peaceably with the other person. You can't make them speak peaceably with you, but you can speak peaceably with them. You can be the healthy half of a relationship that otherwise wouldn't exist in a healthy way. You introduce that half and let the other person conform to the relationship you're generating by being the healthy half of a relationship. So, I mean, those are just examples of what I'm talking about. Let me give you just a few more, but in a different direction. Behavioral examples. Those are sort of behavioral, but they're relational too, so I put them in the relational category. But behavioral examples of how we produce the things that we're trying to avoid. So, person's trying to lose weight. I live in a world where my metabolism is such that I have to work out all the time. I ride a bike to work. I do pull-ups, all these things. And I have to restrict what I eat daily, every single day. I've had a particular way of eating that I've lived with for 22 years. And I never break the rules. I have to live with it. I was telling somebody the other day, I could gain 15 pounds a week if I wanted to. I'm not saying I would necessarily enjoy it. But I would enjoy part of it. I guarantee you. I would just be eating what I wanted to eat. If I did all of that, I mean, I would never control my weight. So I understand what it is for people to think, oh, I got to control my weight. I got to work on this. So a person's trying to lose weight. What's one of the most obvious and initial things that people do? Skip meals, right? So I'm going to skip a meal. I'm going to skip lunch. I'm going to skip breakfast. I'm going to skip a day's eating. I'm going to fast. I'm going to do whatever. And so trying to lose weight, I'm going to skip a meal. So what do you end up doing? Well, you end up starving at the wrong time of day with the wrong foods now available to you and with lack of self-restraint because you're starving. And so you're grabbing the marshmallows or the Twinkies or the donuts or the whatever's handy, the McDonald's. And all of those things are fine. I'm not indicting them. Don't sue me if you happen to produce one of those foods. Your food is amazing. But it should be used at the right time and in the right way, right? And that's the point, that if you plan for a meal, then you plan for it appropriately. If you skip a meal, then you're set. And I'm not saying this is the only thing. I mean, obviously, you could make this mistake 100 other ways. And maybe skipping meals, intermittent fasting, if you want to be more technical about it, is a great way to lose weight. I'm just saying, I see it happen all the time. I've practiced it myself. I know what it is that on something like trying to lose weight, you can actually bring about the result that you're trying to avoid, depending on how you approach it. let me put it in the ministry context. Pastors or volunteers, and sometimes pastors are volunteers, I'm not separating the two, but pastors or lay people who are doing everything in a church because they just want to get the job done. They just want to get things done. And yet, they're killing themselves because no one else will do the work. And what they want is a ministry that's flourishing and where the chairs are all in place and people show up and there's music and there's singing and there's rejoicing and there's the word preached and people are responding and, you know, the ministry's flourishing. But others don't volunteer. What's going on? Well, they're not needed. They don't see where they're needed. We just, and you know, when I say this to people, I say, well, why do you think no one else is participating? Why is no one else? Why are you burning yourself out doing everything by yourself? And in a small church, like a single staff church or a church that doesn't even have a full-time staff member, very often one or two or a half dozen people are burning themselves out and they don't understand why it's happening. And I will say, well, why are you doing everything? And they'll say, because it needs to be done. And I just want to make sure it gets done. And their motivations are pure. Absolutely nothing wrong with their motivations. Their desire is simply to serve the church, to serve the body of Christ. And they want to do it in the best way they possibly can. But actually, what they're bringing about is an environment that's not sustainable. They are bringing about the demise of their own ability to accomplish all these things because by saying, well, I just want to get it done because, you know, I'm being faithful, I'm going to accomplish this ministry, in reality, what we're supposed to be getting done is the equipping of disciples. And they're being put into service, being used by God for their own ministries. And if we're doing everything, we don't leave room for anyone else to do everything. You know how many churches there are baptizing? And I mean, so I know there are not enough of these churches, but there are a lot more of these than you would think. How many churches there are who are baptizing, let's say 15 to 50 people every year? There are a bajillion churches who do that. And if it's not baptizing, then bringing into the congregation, making new members of, however your church does it, however your church participates in that. But, you know, there are a billion churches doing that. I'm making that. Obviously, there aren't a billion, but you know what I mean. There are a bunch of churches doing that. You know why? Because that's what one person completely committed to that type of ministry can produce. And so a lot of churches have a pastor or an outreach leader who does all of that work. And the indication of it is in the number that person can produce in a year. But there are very few churches that are having an abundance beyond that, that are seeing hundreds of people added to their congregation every year, or hundreds of people made into better disciples each year, or a few dozen made into better disciples each year. Because they start multiplying by teaching other people how to take on those responsibilities. And the reason for it is simple. We don't want a dry well. We don't want nothing. And so we're just going to run out and do what we can immediately and produce what we can. And by producing what we can, we're actually bringing about something of a dry well for the rest of the congregation because we're not giving them a place or a way to serve themselves. Also in ministry context, by the way, and I'll say this one as briefly as I can, you would think I would need to say everything as briefly as I can, right? But that's just really not a question for me. Pastoral search committees do this a lot. And so I work with a lot of pastoral search committees because I, you know, consult with churches. I do interims and things like that. And when I'm talking to pastoral search committees, one of the things I will say is, you know, what you're going to want to do is produce a list of characteristics for your next pastor. If you didn't like your previous pastor, that list will include things that you didn't like about your previous pastor. You know, things you wanted to be true about him that weren't, or things that were true about him you don't want in the next guy. So, you know, you're going to have, you know, you'll show up at the office at 8 and won't leave before 5, you know, if the guy never showed up at the office. Or you'll put, is gentle and caring about other people, if he was brusque and, you know, inconsiderate of other people, and so on. And in reality, by producing that list, what you end up producing in the candidates, as they read the profile that you define for them, make sure you're like this. Well, what do you think they're going to say when you say to them, are you pastoral? They're going to say, oh, yeah, you know, I read your profile and I understand you need somebody who's caring. Well, of course I'm caring. And well, tell us about your work hours. Well, I guarantee I'm going to show up before 8 and won't leave before 5. Of course they're going to say those things, and they're going to believe them. They're not lying to you. They're saying to themselves, wow, if I'm going to get this position, I need to become this kind of person. But they're not going to change because they read your profile. They're really going to be the same person that they were before. But now they know how to answer your question. So you end up getting a person who's actually going to struggle with the very thing you were trying to avoid being in the person that you wanted to call to your church, and so on. So, and by the way, I know it sounds like I'm just playing a game where people might do these things. No. I'm talking about long experience watching people get exactly the opposite of what they want in all of the kinds of examples that I've been giving above. But let's give some more pertinent or maybe even more important examples from some things that are going on right now in both cases, socially and in terms of Christianity itself. So let me give a social example. And let me give an innocuous social example first, just so you get the point. Technology is this way. And, you know, if you, like, for instance, put it in the context of Star Trek, I hate to do that, but I do watch sci-fi. That's my escapism, is watching some sci-fi. And Star Trek is my preferred sci-fi. I know Star Wars is out there. It's tolerable. But Star Trek is my thing. I know. I'm just kidding. I love all of it. It's fine. But in Star Trek, there's this utopian elimination of human desire through technological abundance. Star Wars has a lot more of the gritty, you know, people are still struggling kind of stuff going on. Star Trek, you know, part of the theme of it is, well, we've used technology to produce so much that there's no more normal economy. People have everything they want. There's no reason for us to have to struggle anymore, and so on like that. Now, I'm not saying it stays there all the time, but that's the gist of what's going on underneath it, that we should be moving toward a utopian existence as a civilization. In reality, what we face is this, and this comes from Reinhold Niebuhr, by the way. This is actually a quote from his Moral Man and Immoral Society work, one of his most famous works. He says, unfortunately, the conquest of nature and the consequent increase in nature's beneficences to man, so this is producing technology so we can control nature around us, right? They have not eased, but rather accentuated the problem of justice. The same technology which drew fangs of nature's enmity of man, also created a society in which the intensity and extent of social cohesion has been greatly increased, and in which power is so unevenly distributed that justice has become a more difficult achievement. That is, as we develop technology, we actually create greater inequities in a society that we were trying to make more equitable by producing more protection from nature's vagaries. We tried to produce all of that, but in reality produced an economy that's so dependent on the work and the skill that brings about the technological advantage that a few people become mega, mega billionaires flying into outer space. You get the idea. So, I mean, and by the way, this is from Reinhold Niebuhr in the middle of the 20th century, anticipating what would be coming with technology. He was seeing it at the same time, but also anticipating it. So, you know, in another social example, I would say we look at, and I'm saying this as a believer now, let me just speak as a believer for a moment. We look at a goal of seeing Christianity be able to flourish, being in a society where Christianity can flourish, where the ideas of Christianity can be expressed and not suffocated, where we can speak freely and openly of our faith and practice it without intimidation, all those kinds of things. And yet, one of the ways that we think Christianity can flourish, and I'm not saying I do or that you personally do, but as a body, evangelical Christianity has had a tendency lately to think in terms of overpowering opposing views. And how would that be? You know, what is the thing that we're trying to accomplish by doing that? Well, we don't want ideas that suppress Christianity or that oppose Christianity, overwhelming Christianity. So how are we going to overpower those views? And what we end up producing it by trying to suppress those views is a Christianity that looks the opposite of the way that Christ describes it. Christ describes a Christianity where his strength is being most obviously revealed in our weaknesses, you know, Paul. Christ describes Christianity as whoever is greatest among you will be your servant. Whoever is least among you shall be first. This is how Christ describes Christianity. But what we produce is one in which our strength, I've won the election, I have control of this, I, with my celebrity, can create this enormous congregation, and so on. Our strength actually obscures his. And it doesn't, by the way, this is not an indictment on having a big church or having success in something of your ministry or in some other influence that you're having in society. It is the way we can turn those things into our strength, actually obscuring his strength, where faith is not bringing this about at all. It's the stuff that anybody else would do. I just happen to attach it to my Christianity. We produce great leaders among ourselves. Oh, that man knows how to lead. He could be leading a Fortune 500 company. I've heard that said about so many Christian leaders. I say so many. I've heard it said about probably a half dozen Christian leaders in denominational settings where I've been. And I back up and I want to think to my, I want to say out loud, but I think to myself, is that really the goal of how we're trying to produce Christian leaders? That they would have been a great leader whether they were a Christian or not? Or do we want God's strength to be revealed through us? I mean, and I'm not saying a person who would be a great leader otherwise can't be a faithful servant to Christ. Of course they can. But shouldn't it be somehow evident that what's happening is happening because of faith? So you can see how we can sometimes produce the opposite of what we're trying to produce. We want people to see Christianity, but we're showing them our own strength. And by the way, if we're another option here where we're producing the opposite of what we want to produce a place where Christianity's flourishing, but we can often, if we're using force or we're using our power or overwhelming presence to produce it, we can produce commitments in other people that are perfunctory or involuntary. So, for instance, right now there's a move to censor literature, to say you can't put these kinds of books in the library, you can't have this kind of literature in the school, and we know the public school teachers, we don't trust them, we're not going to let them use a certain kind of book when they're teaching. We want to control the vocabulary that's used, or we're trying to control the educational system itself. And that kind of censoring, you know, there are only two real results that we're going to be able to produce. One of the options, one of the results it leaves us with, is that the information that we don't like, and reasonably, I mean, there's a lot of information that's bad, destructive, harmful to anybody. But that information, if we censor it, leaves the public sphere, leaves the sphere where it's known, leaves the sphere where it can be held accountable, even retroactively. Oh, you read that? Well, let me show you a few things about this that you ought to consider. It leaves that world for the underground, where people get access to it in speakeasies, and it becomes something that multiplies in this place where people say, oh, those people up there don't understand what we understand. You create that kind of environment, because just like with, you know, when the United States was producing the atomic bomb, and I mean the atomic bomb, when we were first producing it, you know, the acts of our government were often inclined to say, well, let's make sure no other nation finds out about this. And the scientists were saying, well, that's not really an option. It's just science. They're finding out about it. There are scientists from all over the world who've been involved in it from the beginning. It's just a matter of discovery here. It's the same thing with this. It's not like the information ceases to exist because you censor a book. So one is that you actually remove layers of accountability by forcing it into the underground. The other option is that all we evince is our fear that we can't actually win in a free exchange of ideas. Is that what we think? That's not what I think. That's not what I was brought up to think, and it's not what I think is true about God to begin with. I'm good with it, man. Let's have a free exchange of ideas in an open marketplace, and I think if Christianity's true, since it is, it'll win. And that's what the power of the resurrection does. So there you go. There's another example of what I'm talking about. Roger Williams is a testimony to this, by the way, in Cairns's Christianity Through the Centuries, sort of a history of Christianity book. It's a textbook that's used in church history classes all the time. Roger Williams is kicked out of Salem because, and listen to this, this is a quotation from that church history book, he upheld the Indian ownership of land. That's a matter to discuss differently, but good for him. Anyway, he upheld the Indian ownership of land, opposed a state church, and insisted that the magistrates had no power over a man's religion. Roger Williams took this position that said, and I'm not saying Roger Williams was a saint or that he ended up in exactly the right place or any of that kind of stuff, but these are fundamental to our understanding about religious liberty. His whole premise was, if you force people to be religious, what kind of religion are you giving them? If you don't allow for religious freedom, then you're not allowing for religious sincerity. So he promoted it in that direction. We could end up promoting the very thing we're trying to avoid by suffocating ideas that disagree with what we're trying to advocate in Christianity. Let me give more specific Christian examples. We have a goal to, as believers, understand, grasp, and also communicate about the validity and power of our own redemption, of our salvation. It is so important to us, so fundamental to how we identify ourselves. We've been made new creatures, is how we understand ourselves, that we want to make sure that we ourselves rest in the strength, the power of the cross and the resurrection, and that that's what we're communicating to others. So we want to say the words, the cross redeems us from sin. And it does, of course. So, as we're thinking through this, the cross redeems us from sin. Others look at us and they say, well, so what was going on with that sin it doesn't look like you've dealt with? Because as people from outside of Christianity look at Christians, they accuse us of, what's the biggest accusation? Hypocrisy, right? Oh, you say you've overcome sin. Then why are you practicing gluttony? Because you carry it around with you everywhere you go, and it's sort of obvious. By the way, that's not inherently true. That's not naturally true. But people assume it. And sometimes it is the truth. So why are you carrying your gluttony around with you so obviously? Why do you practice greed? And we got plenty of that in Christianity. Why are you still practicing racism? Why are you involved with pornography? Why is there a sex abuse scandal in the Catholic Church or in the Baptist Church or in whatever denomination we're looking at right now? And so on. So others are looking at us and saying, why haven't you dealt with your sin? And the response we want to give, I'm not saying me personally, nor you personally, but a lot of believers do this. The response people want to give is, the cross covers it. You should understand that I've been forgiven. I'm not saying I'm perfect. I'm just saying I'm forgiven. The cross covers it. In reality, we need to rethink this. Does the cross cover our sins? Well, yes, of course. And there's a beautiful sense in which Christianity is entirely about how love covers a multitude of sins. That's a quotation, by the way, if you think I'm going soft on you, look it up. In reality, we need to ask this question. Does the cross simply cover sin, or does it also expose sin? And I'm going to make this as clear as I can. Don't hide behind the cross to avoid what the cross itself is showing you needs to be addressed in your life. There's nothing in the way Christianity is given to us in the New Testament where we're supposed to assume that the moment we bow at the cross and receive the forgiveness that belongs to us through Christ and his sacrifice and the power of his resurrection, that we get up and now
We are sinlessly perfect. Now we walk as saints in a land filled with sinners. There's nothing in the New Testament that purports that. The churches are not perfect. The way they live out their lives is not perfect. The testimony they have in their community is not perfect. And it's as obvious as the rebukes that they receive from Peter and James and Paul and John in the epistles of the New Testament. They are constantly coming up in this sense of, you got to correct this. You've got to deal with this. Why haven't you fixed this? And he doesn't say it to them, you must not be believers. He says, why aren't you acting like the thing you are? Why isn't it clear that the cross actually has redeemed you in the way that you're living? Because the cross itself reveals the need we have to live better than the way we're living right now. So don't hide behind the cross to avoid what the cross itself is showing us needs to be fixed. We know how, like, you've experienced this. You've seen this. We know how abusers have used the cross to cover up what the cross's power demands to expose. So abusers or enablers will say, oh, but you should forgive me. Yeah, I did that. But, you know, you owe me this forgiveness. I've sat in the counselor's seat as a pastor. I've sat in the seat and watched a husband say those words. Oh, yeah, it is true that I abused you. It's true that I hurt you. It's true that I wounded you. It's true that I said those things. It's true that I did those things. But I mean, look, we're Christians. You should forgive me. This is using the cross to cover up what the cross is exposing. What our commitment to Christ says is not acceptable, a way we cannot live. And so the Messiah, he doesn't walk into the temple and say, you guys are cheating all the people of Israel, but it's okay. I'm here to cover it up. Don't worry about it. I'll make it so nobody knows you perpetrated these harms on the people of God. You sit at your table. I'll clean it up. I'll straighten up the accounting a little bit, and then nobody will know that this went wrong. Man, he's throwing over the money changers' tables. They were the abusers. He's cursing abusive religious leaders' legalistic requirements. I mean, he is cursing them. You are whited sepulchers. You will face twice the judgment because of what you've done. He is pronouncing judgment on them, and he's the Messiah who did not come to condemn, but to redeem. And yet, when he's looking at religious leaders, not, he never does this with a sinner outside. He never does it with those who are poor, impoverished. He does it with those who are in positions of power. Zacchaeus heard what the cross, Zacchaeus is an example of how we ought to be doing this. Zacchaeus comes down from the cross, sees Jesus, doesn't say, oh, Lord, I'm so thankful you've forgiven me for all the money I've stolen from everyone and that now I can keep that money and not have to deal with it. That's not what he says. Zacchaeus, you know, comes down, meets Jesus. Jesus meets him. He's rejoicing in it. And his rejoicing is to say, oh, Lord, half of my goods I give to the poor. And when he says, and if I have defrauded, the language, the way he says it is open to the interpretation. And since I have defrauded these people of things, I restore it fourfold. And Jesus said to him, today salvation's come to this house, since he also is a son of Abraham. He's receiving it because he's one of the people of God. And his response was to accept the accountability that goes with that. Look, there are lessons that we should learn to avoid falling into the kind of trap where we bring about the things that we're trying to avoid. Lessons to avoid actualizing these practically universally present ironies that happen in our lives. So this, in the context of anyone, I'm just going to say two things, two directions, things we can introduce into our way of thinking about what we do, how we behave, that can keep us from falling into the trap. I'm not pretending that these are so powerful that they'll immediately change your life, but just things we ought to consider to avoid being the kind of people who bring about the very things we're trying to avoid. So for anyone, believer or non-believer, I would say, number one, stop trying to control results. This is number one, the thing to do. Stop trying to control the results. Stop, and that includes not trying to control other people's responses, how they behave, what they do as a reaction to you. Stop trying to control the results. For believers, that means relinquish our ends for God's. That is, stop trying to decide what I want the end, the product, the result to be, and accept that God has a plan. He has an outcome for me, and lean into that. Accept it, pursue it, follow it, but accept that it's his end that matters, not mine. So first is choosing to exchange my ends for God's ends. Second, and this applies to anyone, would be this way, choose to do what's right before you decide whether it's going to work or not. That is, don't give up what's right for just what works. But to put it in the context of believers, for those of us who are following Christ, relinquish your means, relinquish our means for his. Decide that the way he's given us, the path he has given us, is the path that we should follow always. Not, well, that's where I want to end up, and I know this path is one God tells us not to take, but this gets us to the result we want, so I'm going to go that way instead. No. We have to relinquish our means for God's means as well, and we have to do it always, which means we have to choose faithfulness, which some people would refer to as integrity. We have to choose sacrifice, a willingness to lose. We have to choose altruism, to love our enemies, because, after all, love is the great commandment.
Thanks for joining us for Coffee with Creamer. Your cup of coffee may be finished, but we are not. Come back next week for a refill as we sit down to examine a new set of ideas and cultural issues. Don't miss an episode. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts or visit our website at barrycreamer.com. Until next time, keep your mug hot and your mind sharp.